This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. It's been 1 year since Christian Cooper, a black man who was bird watching in the Ramble in New York City's Central Park, asked a nearby woman to obey the park rules and leash her dog. She refused, and before the confrontation ended, the woman called the police while Christian recorded her with his smartphone. In response to this incident, a group of people called the Black AF in STEM Collective organized the first ever Black Birders Week, an initiative that celebrated the joys of birdwatching while at the same time examining how outdoor spaces can be threatening and dangerous to people of color. This weekend, Black Birders Week is back. Online events run from Sunday, May 30th through Saturday, June 5th. And so we wanted to bring you this interview we did last year with one of the organizers, Danielle Bellany. Danielle is a wildlife biologist at Plateau Land and Wildlife Management in Texas and one of the co-organizers of Black Birders Week. Danielle, thanks for speaking with me.
I'm excited to be here.
I kind of want to just start with a little real talk. So like if there are listeners out there who are rolling their eyes and saying like, do we need to bring race into birding too? Like, can we just bat that aside? Like, what are the types of experiences that you've had with white birders?
Yeah, so I mean, the fact that people think that racism doesn't happen in the birding community is pretty, I mean, it's laughable to me. Racism is going to happen anywhere where I am. It's because I'm black that racism happens to me. I've been followed around by people that are on trails because I think I look suspicious with my binoculars while I'm staring at bushes or like trees and stuff. Or I've also had the cops called on me while I've been working. And it's really frightening when those situations happen. And it's just like, I'm just trying to do my job. I'm trying to like be out here and enjoying a nature just like the rest of us.
Can you just tell me a little bit about yourself, like your relationship with the natural world, how you got excited about it, what it means to you?
Sure. So I am from San Antonio, Texas. I was definitely a very outdoorsy kid growing up. I would pick up the bugs from the lawn. I would pick up snakes too, like as like a 5-4-year-old. Definitely fearless from the jump of it. I did not know that wildlife biology was something you could actually pursue as a job. I thought you could only be like a zookeeper or like a veterinarian to work with animals. But no, it turns out there's so many other opportunities. And what got me really into research and really into birds was this internship I had doing nest searching in South Texas. And I basically got to watch baby birds grow up the whole summer. And it was really really, really cool to see how a bird turns from an egg to a full bird in like a couple of days. It's an unbelievable process. And I've been watching this black-throated hummingbird nest in my backyard, my first ever hummingbird nest that I found. They just left the nest yesterday, and I'm so happy to be able to watch that whole process happen. It's just magical.
I love it. We have Phoebes that nest under the porch every year, and the great thing about them being under the porch is you can look between the cracks of the boards and like peek at them like really, really close, like a couple inches above the nest. It's so fun.
So cute.
I know. So how did it come together? Because I have to confess, I saw the hashtag, I saw a bunch of, you know, my feed was sort of full of it. But then it wasn't until I clicked on the organizers list and saw how many co-organizers there are that I realized this is really something that, you know, it seems like it came together very quickly, but a lot of enthusiasm from a lot of different quarters.
Oh, absolutely. So immediately after the incident, you know, the black scientist, the black STEM group that I'm in, we have a group chat and we were just, you know, just chatting. It's usually there just for us to hang out and like have a space to be together. But when this incident happened, we were like, oh, we have to say something about this. So a couple of us just had some independent tweets, but then back in the group, Anna Gifty Opuku Agayeman, she is an economist with no background in birds or wildlife sciences. She was like, you guys could actually make a thing out of this. Like, this can get some attention. And within 2 days, we had Black Birders Week organized. We had all kinds of things, you know, lined up. And I think the excitement to put our voices out there and to also just create a community with Black outdoor enthusiasts helped us and pushed us to go all those sleepless hours to create this event in 2 days. It's amazing.
Yeah. And it seems like you've had a lot of interest because, you know, I just heard someone being interviewed on 1A earlier on NPR for the full hour. And we had like, I think, 5 listeners email us and say that we should do something about it. And it's just been everywhere.
My jaw is dropping right now. That's so cool.
So what were the goals? Like, what did you want to accomplish with this?
First off, to uplift and recognize that Black birders and Black outdoor enthusiasts exist. Oftentimes, you know, especially a hobby like birding is considered like, that's an old white guy kind of activity. Like, oh, that's pretty boring. Like, why would you do that? We wanted to provide reassurance through community by reaching out and letting other people that are maybe isolated in their interest know that no, you have friends. We are here. Come join us, even though it's online. We definitely have a community. We also want our non-Black peers to, you know, understand the experiences that Black birders and Black outdoor enthusiasts have, that we're often uncomfortable and unwelcome in these spaces. And we're really just out there trying to find a release, trying to get rid of the stressors that, you know, Black people have on their lives. We are responding to the incident with Christian Cooper and Amy Cooper, but this is also about the murders of other Black lives like Breonna Taylor, Monica Diamond, Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, so many other Black lives being lost because of white supremacy and because of racism.
We on the show have done one birding episode a while ago. I interviewed a guy who was like who at the time had the big year record. Mm-hmm. And so I have an entree into birder culture with like the listers and the twitchers and like the people who are very sort of, it's almost like a sport. I guess I'm wondering is how welcoming this sort of like quirky, insular, sometimes birding community has been to Black birders. Not just the stories of people seeing you with suspicion when you're out there with binoculars, but how actual other white birders react when there's suddenly someone who doesn't look like them in their group.
Right. So for the twitchers, I just learned that word last night. So that's eye opening to me. Like, oh, y'all get called that? Okay, cool. I'll stick with birders. but I think birders in general just want more birders, birders to be birding, want more people to have interest in birds. Because once you like slide somebody into like one little niche interest, they eventually understand like a grander scale of how conservation is really, really important. And you can do that by studying birds and being interested in birds and sending money to bird organizations. I think birders as a whole are very inviting. However, again, you know, once you get inside the group, you do start to realize, oh, you know, yeah, this is the same racism that I experienced when I'm, you know, at school or some other activity. The racism is still the same, but I think the welcomingness of birders and how they're so interested in birding definitely draws people in.
I had seen you tweet that sometimes you feel like you're getting quizzed, like are you really a birder? And they'll like ask you extra questions about like making sure that you're properly IDing birds that, you know, can make you feel like a little bit of an outsider.
Yeah, and that happened less than, I think, like 2 weeks ago. I was out in San Antonio out birding because I just needed to go out. This group of white birders were looking in a bush, and I was like, oh, they seem really excited. Maybe there's something interesting over there. So I walk up to the group and like, hey, what are y'all looking at? They turn around and look at me. They don't say anything, turn back around, start looking at the bird again. I'm like, okay, maybe they didn't hear me, even though I'm a respectable socially distance away from them. But I'm like, okay, let me just ask them one more time. And they turn around. This time they actually like acknowledge me, and they're like, oh, it's a gray cat bird. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. And I'm here in like my bird hat and like my bird scarf and like my bird shirt. Like, I'm fully nerded out in bird gear. Right. And I think
it's like, how else could I be signaling to you that
honestly,
I belong?
My binoculars are on my chest. I've been like with my eBird app. Like, I look like such a dork right now. Like, let me be a dork with y'all. But I mean, I also don't care about the projections of white birders and what they think of me. I'm going to do what I do because I love it, and I don't need their validation to do that.
What would you recommend for Black people who are listening, who are interested in doing things like bird watching, but maybe feel hesitant because it is seen as such a white hobby and they need a little inspiration?
Do you? I mean, you can go out birding without binoculars. As long as you have an interest and a passion, that's really all you need. Also, you know, find us online at Black AF and STEM. We want to hear your voices. We want to connect with you. Like, that's why we are here.
And then also, any recommendations for white people who are listening and, you know, ways that they could be better in terms of being welcoming and being allies?
Sure. Yeah. I would say speak up when you hear something that is racist. Like, we need our allies to be actively anti-racist. And also donate. I mean, if you can donate to a local Black organization, a Black Nature organization or something, to help other Black kids get access to these wonderful things that are outside, paving the way for more diversity. If we understand like the importance of ecological diversity in a system, the fact that we have so many connections through so many species and it makes a more resilient community, we can do that same thing through diversity in our spaces. It'll make a more stronger and more resilient community in the same sense.
Right. Danielle Bellany, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Danielle Bellany is a wildlife biologist and one of the co-organizers behind Black Birders Week. There were so many amazing, inspirational, and sometimes heartbreaking stories that were shared last year for Black Birders Week. Danielle and her co-organizers asked you to share them with us via voicemail.
This is Day Scott, recording from Lander, Wyoming. As a Black person in Wyoming, I don't walk around at night. I don't know. It just does not feel comfortable for me to do that. When I'm out birding, I always make sure that my equipment can be seen. Along with my, right now wearing a Cotopaxi backpack, it's really bright and colorful. I want people to see me. I want people to know that, oh, that's just Day. We know her. Because I don't want any incidents. I am here by myself as a Black woman in a small town in Wyoming. When I heard about Black Birders Week, I was able to channel some of the fear, anger, and sadness into hope, awareness, and comfort. I found my voice. I found a lane that I can be in, as I cannot really attend any events with crowds due to my brain injury. Black Birders Week simply made me feel like I belong. Though it was through a virtual community, it created a voice that had been silenced due to fear. It opened the joy of sharing my gift and allowing others to experience nature through my eyes.
That voicemail came from a contributor to Black Birders Week 2020. Black Birders Week 2021 is happening this week, May 30th through June 5th. You can visit blackafinstem.com. That's black, the letters afinstem.com for more details about the week. And you can follow the hashtag BlackBirdersWeek2021 for more on social media. Coming up after the break, if you don't know very much about birding and you want to learn, don't worry, we've got you covered. Stay tuned for some basics of backyard birding.
At the end of his tail feathers, he's like silver. It's kind of silver.
Very regal, just sitting there.
Yes. I love watching birds.
Welcome back to Outside In. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Last spring, we weren't exactly sure how to be outside in the world. Recommendations and rules about what you could do and where were all over the place. But there was one activity that we were confident could be done safely. Producer Taylor Quimby and his son Phineas produced this story on the basics of backyard birding last spring.
He's come down. He's by the grass. It looks like the same kind to me.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Oh, in right yellow beak. I saw his yellow beak up on the tree.
Yellow beak. there is a kind of birdwatching, or birding, where people travel all over the world to see as many types of birds as possible. But there's another type of birdwatching that anybody can do, from the comfort of a backyard or even a kitchen window, without any special tools or bird expertise at all. That's the type of birding we're going to talk about today, and we've roped in a few bird lovers to give us some tips on how to do it. First up is Bridget.
So, hi, my name's Bridget Butler. I live in northern Vermont, right near the Quebec border, and I'm known as the bird diva.
Bridget started young. She still remembers waking up in a tent next to an apple tree on a bird watching trip and having her first real bird experience. You know, like the one.
It was spring, and there's the apple tree in blossom, and at the top of the tree is an indigo bunting.
Indigo buntings are cheery, little bright blue birds with a wonderful sing-song voice that migrate at night, using the stars to guide them.
And this guy is just singing his heart out. And that was my hook bird. That was the one that got me. And I was like, this is really cool.
Bridget teaches classes on how to do what she calls slow birding, which, when she describes it, sounds a little bit like yoga or meditation practice.
I encourage people to start right out your back door. My sit spot is literally on my back step.
If you've got a backyard or a quiet outdoor spot you can safely get to, let's go there together. Here's how she likes to start birdwatching.
Just slow your steps down. Take notice of how your body is feeling. Drop your shoulders.
You see, birdwatching isn't just about looking for birds. It's about opening up your senses, about bringing your mind into the present.
Get comfortable, take a couple of deep cleansing breaths.
If you don't have a backyard, or you live in a building with a lot of other people, it's okay just to open a window and start there. Even high up, you'd be surprised what birds are out there. Did you know that the fastest bird in the world, the peregrine falcon, likes to roost and hunt in New York City, right around the skyscrapers? Anyway, I've been trying Bridget's method in the mornings. I like to brew up some coffee, open up my kitchen window, and stick my head right out into the sunshine. Sometimes your mind might wander, a noisy car drives by, or a person who wonders why you're sticking your head out the window.
Morning.
Don't worry about it.
Acknowledge them and like let them go. And then open up your senses, take a deep breath, smell.
Some days, you'll notice you can hear a lot of birds, but you don't see any. Don't worry, that's normal. One of the most important birding tools you have are your ears. Bridget has a little exercise to help get them working.
The other part that I like to think about is how far away can I listen? Can I listen close? Can I listen to my neighbor's house? Can I listen beyond my neighbor's house? Can I listen above me and in front of me?
Really good birders can identify a lot of birds just by their songs and calls, and can even tell whether the bird is looking for a mate or warning other birds about nearby predators. That's not the case for beginners like me and my son. So Bridget gave us some things to listen for, a few bird call genres, so to speak.
One of them is like the clear sound, like chickadee. So black-capped chickadees, we have them in Vermont here, you have them where you guys are there in New Hampshire. So their mating song is, hey, sweetie, hey, sweetie. You can actually whistle that.
Another category of bird call you might hear is what's called a trill.
And you do that with your tongue. Kind of choppy da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da quality to it.
And yet another category is a buzzy sort of insect sound.
So if you're like, some birds have all of those within their song, which is really cool. So the song may start out one way with a nice clear note and then go into something that's more buzzy toward the end.
Listen to this guy, the brown thrasher. He has more than 1,000 song types and can even do covers of other bird songs. Birds.
Mm-hmm. way.
Yeah.
Kind of like a squeak and a chirp mixed together.
Let me hear. What does it sound like to you? Well, that's pretty good. Finn, you're doing really good sound.
Thanks.
It's funny they call it bird watching.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of it is about bird listening.
Yeah, I think they should call it bird listening.
If you're lucky and patient, the birds that you hear might wander into view. To get a sense of what to look for should you actually see one, we talked to J. Drew Lanham, an ornithologist and professor at Clemson University in South Carolina. He didn't have a hook bird like Bridget. When he was a kid, Drew wanted to be a hook bird.
I would go out and attempt to fly. I would construct wings of cardboard, parachutes of plastic bags, tried to float down from ladders, haystacks, and roofs with umbrellas. Sometimes there was evidence. I did break a collarbone.
Point is, Drew admired birds.
A second grade teacher, a woman by the name of Ms. Beasley, she gave us pictures of birds to color. That started it.
When observing a bird on a branch or on the ground or in the sky, it's best to think of yourself as an investigator.
If this, then that. If this, then that, not that.
Don't jump to a conclusion about what kind of bird you're seeing. To start with, just gather clues.
Is the bird larger or smaller than a crow?
And of course, pay close attention to color.
And not just thinking Roy G. Biv.
Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet.
But beginning to think about shades, to have fun with describing colors.
Apricot, scarlet, almond, aquamarine. You're not just looking at color to identify the species. Just like an investigator, some small clues may tell you a lot more than you think. Most male birds, for instance, have brighter colors than females. The adult male summer tanager, Drew tells me, is watermelon red. The female is a mustardy yellow. Young males are a splotchy patchwork of the two.
Those splotchy colors tell you that that's a male that was hatched just last year.
Drew says to keep asking yourself questions about what you're seeing. Jot down the notes, maybe even draw a picture in your notebook if you can.
Look at the bill. Is the bill long or is the bill short? Is it conical shaped or is it sharp?
Of course, birds can be small and you might be looking from a distance.
Binoculars can help you.
Don't have a pair?
I'll tell you, you can take toilet paper tubes, which I think there are probably plenty of these days. Put those tubes together and those tubes together become binoculars.
They're super easy to make, so.
Okay, so maybe a pair of toilet paper tube binoculars won't help you zoom in. But we tried them, and what they did do was help us focus our attention.
I can't believe it, but these cardboard tube binoculars actually really do help.
Mm-hmm. Plus, they were fun.
Hey, Finn, look. There's another one. What size is he? Is he bigger or smaller than a crow?
He's smaller than a crow. Darkish head, red belly.
What's his beak shape?
Like a snout point, a pointy snout.
I really like watching birds, but I've never spent much time trying to identify them. Luckily, if you do the investigative legwork, there are some really helpful tools out there for beginners like me and Finn. One of them is an app that Bridget suggested called Merlin, made by the folks at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology.
It's like magic. You hit go and it spits out a list of possible birds based on your location.
Cool.
House finch.
House finch. No.
No. Purple finch.
No.
No.
Yep.
American robin.
Mm-hmm.
That really looks like what we saw.
Yeah.
What does it say?
Fairly large songbird with ground body, long legs.
The folks at Cornell aren't just trying to help people identify birds. They're also looking for volunteers, like you, to help them collect data.
All day long, I've been watching this eastern phoebe has been bringing nest materials to my back porch.
This is Robin Bailey. Her first bird ID was also, can you believe it, a robin. And she is the project manager for NestWatch, one of Cornell's citizen science projects that anyone can contribute to. If there's a bird nest that you can see from your window or in your backyard, she wants to hear about it.
These data are the foundation of what we know about how birds nest, how many eggs they lay, how successful they are, and why. We would be getting all kinds of data from just that bird that's nesting on your front porch, in your flower pot.
Robin says citizen bird watchers help their team monitor somewhere between 27 and 28,000 nests every year. And with all the changes we've been experiencing lately, this could be a really valuable time to study bird nesting behavior.
I'm curious if this spring, with things being really quiet outside, if birds will do anything differently.
Whether you're collecting data or just watching out the window for fun, there really is something amazing about birds, isn't there?
Some warbler that ends up in your yard is your link to a tropical rainforest. That's that's pretty amazing to me, that the birds that someone saw in Central America just a few days ago are suddenly in my backyard. That again is stitching the world together with feathers.
And even though you might not be able to visit your friends or your family in person, you can do what Drew does. Think of the birds outside your window as messengers, little gifts that we can send to one another.
I just wrote a friend of mine, and I said, Frank, I'm sending you black-throated green warblers. They're here now. I know that there are some of them headed your way.
Who knows? Maybe if you're paying close enough attention, I'll send a bird your way, too.
Chee-weep. Chee-weep.
I'm going to write that down. Chee-weep.
Chee-weep.
Hey, sweetie.
That's producer Taylor Quimby and his son, Phineas. Now, like we mentioned at the top, capital B birding for some people is an activity that feels a bit like a sport. There are lists, competitions, and I have to say, all that is not for me. So if what we're doing with this episode is encouraging people who are stuck at home to try out backyard birding, I want to use this opportunity to instill a new value in all of these new birders.
Sure.
I want you to fall in love with common birds.
I'm Karen Purcell.
And to help you do that, we're going to talk to Karen.
I am project leader for Celebrate Urban Birds at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, which is a citizen science project that's available really all over the continent. It's available in both Spanish and English, and it's for beginner birders or folks that are just interested in learning about birds in their neighborhood, whether it be a city or the suburbs or the country.
Now, I'm not a birder, or at least I'm a really bad birder, but I do know my birds. I know the eastern phoebe building a nest under the porch. I know the American robin building a nest on the garage. I know the various types of woodpeckers constantly hammering the trees all around my house. And so does my son.
No woodpecker.
Which is why I really like Celebrate Urban Birds. It's a citizen science project, which if you're just trying to start something new, like starting to pay attention to birds because you want that distraction, it'll give you some structure.
It is citizen science, and so there are very clear protocols or instructions on how to watch. And the reason we provide those is because if we want to be able to compare the data that or the observations that I'm collecting here in Ithaca with someone in New York City or in Los Angeles, we need everybody to be watching or observing in the same way.
You pick an area about the size of half a basketball court, and sit out for 10 minutes three times a month, and you write down any birds that you see in your little personal study area. The birds you're looking for are mostly really common ones. Robins, crows, mourning doves, pigeons. But here's the catch. Yes, this is, quote, for science, unquote. But just forget about that for a second. The science is just an excuse. That's just a commitment device to get you out the door. Now you're out here. You're sitting in your spot where you can see your half a basketball court and a bird. Something has actually flitted into the spot that you're studying. Now, do not pick up your pencil.
Well, one of the most common mistakes that we see people make are that they see a bird and they're super excited about seeing the bird. And so they immediately then shift their eyes from the bird to their app or their guide. And what we recommend is not to do that. If you see a bird, keep watching that bird. Watch everything about it. And then when the bird flies away, then actually go and try to figure out what it is.
Karen probably wouldn't put it this way, but I'll say it. Citizen science. Yeah, it gathers data in a rigorous way that researchers can use. But a lot of times, that's kind of just the side benefit. A lot of times, they've designed these projects with the goal of breaking us out of our routine, of showing us something that's wonderful and powerful and right in front of our eyes if we can just stop looking at our darn phones for a second. And that's one of the reasons birds, especially common birds, urban birds, are so perfect. They're a miracle, and they're right in front of us. Take pigeons.
I am stuck on pigeons. I just think pigeons are fascinating. The fact that they feed their young pigeon milk in the first week of life, and that males and the females take such equal turns in raising the young and making the nest, and it's just, to me, the behaviors of pigeons are just really interesting. I think a lot of folks say, well, I've never seen a pigeon nest or you know, a young pigeon, but you do see young pigeons all the time. They look like adults, but they've got their cirri, or the little skin that's above their nose, is a different color. And so, again, watching little details like that is super fascinating. Killdeer is another bird that I absolutely love, in particular because of the behaviors that they will engage in when they see a person or a predator coming towards their nest. They deserve some kind of Broadway award. They throw themselves on the ground, and right on the underwing, they've got some a little bit of red, so it looks like they're hurt. They will flop around on the ground. And so if you're a fox and you're headed for their nest and about to eat their eggs, but suddenly you see a hurt bird, a hurt adult, and that becomes a tasty treat. And so you start following the adult as it flops around, and you don't notice that it's flopping around and guiding you away from the nest. And so you keep following it, and then suddenly it flies off. And at that point, you don't remember where the nest is.
I don't want to be too harsh on the capital B birders. I love obsessives and passionate people. I've just decided that lists and driving all over creation just to twitch a rare bird isn't for me. But this, knowing the whole story of the birds I see out my window every day, being able to take one brief look and know that, yep, there's the Phoebe, sitting on the fence post, sallying out to catch a fly whenever one drifts within range. She's having her morning hunt. Or seeing a downy woodpecker working on a white pine and knowing, yeah, that tree probably isn't doing so well. Looks like it's full of rot and bugs, and maybe it'll come down in a few years. These are the stories that birds bring us. And frankly, these are the kinds of stories I need to fill my head with right now.
Look!
Coming up, the urban evolution of pigeons and what pigeons have to say about how we humans define urbanization. That's after a quick break. You're listening to Outside In. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Until recently, if I were to name the top factors that distinguish Boston and New York City, off the top of my head, I might have said, the accent, the sports teams, you know, Red Sox versus Yankees, the chowder. But that was then. I now have something else to point to. Research published in April found that Boston and New York are home to two genetically distinct populations of pigeons. They do not mix.
The pigeons have their own idea of what these cities look like, when obviously we as people really do too. It's just our ideas are kind of a little bit different from the way that a pigeon sees it.
That's Joshua Sokol. He's a freelance writer covering natural history. He wrote a story for the New York Times, which is how we found out that the data says that there are two pigeon megacities in the Northeast, one covering New York and the Mid-Atlantic, the other covering Boston and Providence. And they are separated by Connecticut.
The theory, at least in the paper, is that this is just like a moat that they can't cross. Connecticut is.
Connecticut. What is it about Connecticut that keeps these two pigeon megalopolies separated? To understand, you've got to open up a whole conversation about how different organisms are adapting to cities, a field called urban evolution. We sent our producer, Justine Paradise, to call up the scientist behind the research.
When she arrives in a new city, one of the first things that Elizabeth Carlin does is stop at the local Starbucks, but not just for the coffee.
As I'm getting my coffee, I would say, hey, I have a really weird question. I am trying to figure out where pigeons are in this city. I study urban evolution. Do you know where the pigeons are? Where have you seen pigeons?
Elizabeth Carlin is a pigeon scientist. Well, more accurately,
I would call myself an urban evolutionary biologist and ecologist. It's kind of a broad term. Ecology and evolution are incredibly intertwined.
She's a PhD candidate at Fordham University, and she studies how cities are shaping evolution, specifically right now the evolution of pigeons. Her lab at Fordham also studies coyotes, rats, and salamanders. And when she got there, she was like, we're missing a bird. And what better bird than a pigeon?
Considering humans have been living alongside pigeons for 5 to 10,000 years, how do we not know what their populations look like? Do we not understand how these populations are genetically structured?
When Elizabeth started her dissertation, the question was, do pigeons in the Northeast stick to one city, or do they disperse? But to figure this out, she had to find and catch a lot of birds. And this brings us back to Starbucks, where Elizabeth was asking everyone in line for coffee, where are your pigeons? No, but really, where are they specifically?
Pigeons are not everywhere in a city. I spent a lot of hours driving around cities and not seeing pigeons. And one of the things that I realized was we notice where pigeons are, but we tend to not notice where pigeons are not.
Once she managed to locate a pigeon flock, she would scatter some food on the ground nearby to lure them together. And then she would set up her net gun.
It's a CO2-powered contraption tool that shoots out a net that's about 6 feet by 6 feet over a group of pigeons.
And was that successful? Like, how did that go?
It is. I would catch anywhere from 0 up to 16 pigeons. So I do say, like, I would miss sometimes, but other times, you know, I would get a really good sample size from that area. And because the pigeons were kind of caught in that net, I could then get them out pretty quickly. And they would each individually go into a Whole Foods paper bag that was then sealed with a binder clip. And that way I could process each one, each bird individually.
So you would have like a pigeon in a bag?
Pigeon in a bag, yeah. And, you know, it kind of just looked like bags of groceries sitting out next to me on the street. You couldn't quite tell what was in there. The pigeons are pretty calm once they're in the bag. And I even had people come up to me and be like, hey, are you giving out food donations? And had to say to them, no, I don't think you want what's in here. I don't think you want to eat a city pigeon.
And as Elizabeth was collecting DNA samples and banding the birds, she'd get up really close to the pigeons. I'd notice a lot of details and variation.
They're beautiful birds, actually. The way that they fly, if you watch them fly and kind of navigate, it's really gorgeous. And the colors are quite amazing. So you can kind of think of your standard pigeon as that gray pigeon with the two bars on the wing, and that's referred to as a blue bar. But then they have this very gorgeous iridescent crop that's kind of purple and green.
Every time you see a city pigeon in the United States, you should know that bird is descended from an escaped pet or farm animal. That's why they're called feral pigeons. Pigeons were originally brought to North America as a food source by European colonizers. But they were also bred for their homing and racing abilities, and just like dogs or cats, for other fancy traits. And some of those specially bred pigeons have escaped, and their traits pop up in the feral population too.
Sometimes you'll see all black pigeons or all white pigeons or pigeons that are like a reddish brown. There'll be pigeons that are checkered colored. And if you get really close, you can see that some of them actually have feathered feet. Some of them have different colored toenails.
As you were like conducting the research and, you know, getting pigeon samples in the middle of cities, like, how did people respond to seeing this activity?
A lot of people, well, New Yorkers are kind of like, whatever, do your own thing. It's probably not even the weirdest thing that they saw that day in New York. And I always thought it was really important. I'm a guest in this neighborhood. Wherever I am, I'm a guest. And so it's really important that I invite people to come and experience this with me if they're interested. I had, at one point, a mom in Philadelphia, I was catching some pigeons in a parking lot, and her kids saw me. And she came out and she's like, what are you doing? I was like, oh, I'm just an urban scientist. I study pigeons. She's like, yeah, my kids thought it was really weird. And I was like, oh, do they want to come watch what I'm doing? I can hold off on collecting my data until they're here. And so she's like, yeah, they'd be so into that. She awesome. Went and got her kids and got some chairs out of the back of her car, some folding chairs. And we set up like a little semicircle classroom in this parking lot and had an impromptu science lesson. And the kids helped me weigh the birds and record the data and band the birds and then release them back out into the wild once I had taken the blood sample.
I was just thinking that I guess someone in a city like wouldn't have really see ecological research, but then I was like, wait, actually, I feel like it doesn't matter where you live. Most people just don't see research and how it's done.
Right. And there's this kind of misconception about what a scientist looks like. Are we in the lab all the time in our white coat with our goggles on? And that's not what I look like most of the time.
So Elizabeth, with the help of the neighborhood, collected her samples, banded and released the birds, and then back in the lab, she would sequence the DNA and crunch the data. And she thought that she'd find that each city would have its own pigeon population.
Because if they have food, if they have mates, and if they have shelter, there's no real reason to leave or disperse. So I thought that what I would see is that New York would have a different population from Philadelphia, which would have a different population from Baltimore, which would have a different population from DC. And that's not at all what I found.
Instead, her data told her that pigeons exist in a megacity, interbreeding in a huge collective population from New York to Washington, DC. Except, again, notably, in the case of the New England pigeons, the Boston-Providence population. That population did not interbreed with pigeons in New York and the rest of the Eastern Seaboard.
That was like, okay, what's going on here? This is a huge kind of area from New York all the way down to DC. That's a huge area for pigeons to consider like a single city. And then why were the Boston pigeons kind of falling out as a separate population?
So Elizabeth started to try to figure it out.
Normally we use, as urban evolutionary biologists, we use impervious surface maps to kind of look at where cities are.
An impervious surface is anything water can't easily soak into, like asphalt, concrete, or surfaces on buildings. But when Elizabeth charted her data on this map, it didn't quite line up.
And so the next thing that I looked at was this map of the East Coast at night with all the urban areas kind of highlighted, because we have so much light pollution in the Northeast that it's actually very bright at night. And what I found was that this light is almost continuous from New York down to Washington, D.C. There's a weird break in Connecticut. And then again, it's very bright around Boston and Providence.
Which did match her data. So what does this tell us? For starters, what we already know, it tells us pigeons are urban birds. They thrive in cities and not in green spaces. Green spaces like suburban Connecticut. Which is an odd thing in itself. But it also tells us something else. Our idea of what counts as a city or what counts as urban might be very different than what a pigeon considers urban.
One of the biggest questions right now in our field is, how do we define urbanization? Are there different metrics that we should be using? Because in a lot of cases, cities might look the same in terms of built-up space, but have a different number of people living in those cities. So someplace like New York versus St. Louis, we can say, yes, those are both very urban places, but obviously New York builds up and St. Louis builds out. And so the urbanization in these two places looks very different.
And just as you can't paint each city with one brush, you also can't generalize how nature responds to urbanization.
Urban evolution is a relatively new field, and it's really cool. For a long time, we kind of thought that evolution took millennia to happen, and it was a very slow process, and therefore organisms couldn't possibly keep up with the rate of urbanization that is occurring. And about a decade ago, researchers started to realize that urban animals can actually change really quickly. They can evolve really quickly, and a lot more quickly than we had ever thought.
Take, for instance, the Puerto Rican anol.
My friend Kristen's work, Dr. Kristen Winchell, her PhD research focused on the Puerto Rican anol, and she found that anole lizards in urban areas have stickier feet and longer limbs.
Both traits that help them in a city, to climb up slick surfaces like glass or painted concrete, or to run more easily between sparsely distributed trees.
Kristen found that these urban lizards repeatedly have these traits in different urban areas in Puerto Rico. And not only that, these traits have evolved multiple times.
Oh, wow.
Independently, because these selection pressures are so strong in these urban areas.
As far as what this all means for pigeons, Elizabeth is still working on her research. One question she wants to answer, it's kind of fun to think about, is, do pigeons flock in families?
Is a flock composed of aunts, uncles, cousins, grandma and grandpa?
But one of the most important things about pigeons might also be the thing that makes them feel so ordinary, that they live so close to us.
If they were to disappear from New York City, if they were to disappear from cities all over the world, I think we would be kind of sad. For a lot of us that live in cities, they're the only wildlife that we see on a daily basis. And therefore, there's this desire to interact with them because they provide some connection to the natural world. And the other great thing about pigeons is everybody has a story about a pigeon. So for my master's research, I worked on an animal called a giant elephant shrew, or giant sengi, which are found in sub-Saharan Africa. I have never seen one alive. I spent years working on this organism and have never seen one alive. And it was hard to get people to relate to that research because it's an animal that most people have never heard of and absolutely never seen.
Yeah.
But pigeons are one of these organisms that everybody has a story about. Everybody's had some interaction. And some of my favorite things have been talking to people and having them tell me, oh yeah, we had these two pigeons that were nesting on our AC unit. We called them Petey and Polly. And they have this whole story about kind of watching this, these pigeons for years on end. And so that makes me really happy. And it, again, is this way to connect to wildlife, which I think is this very innate desire that we have.
That was producer Justine Paradise speaking with researcher Elizabeth Carlin. This episode was produced by Felix Poon, Taylor Quimby, Justine Paradise, and me, Sam Evans Brown. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Music came from Jazzar, Blue Dot Sessions, Ash Turner, Poddington Bear, and Taylor Quimby. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Outside In is a member-supported podcast and a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.